KCI. It makes me wanna. KCI. It makes me wanna. KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this May 29th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. Subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. Your free subscription will get you the latest alerts on when shows are podcast. And who doesn't need a helpful reminder about that? I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with writers about their books, their process, their craft. I'm on now with Patty Seaborn. But first, a treat because Patty is in the studio with me this morning, which almost never happens. So that is exciting. Patty has previously published four collections of poems, Perfecta, Hilarity, which won the Green Rose Prize, given by New Issues Press, Mechanical Cluster, and Diasporatic, which won the 1997 Marianne Moore Poetry Prize and the American Library Association's Notable Book Award for 2000. Her work has appeared in numerous anthologies, most recently the Bloomsbury Anthology of Contemporary Jewish American Poetry, Poetry in Michigan, Michigan in Poetry, and Irresistible Sonnets. Her poems have appeared in many journals, including the Paris Review, Poetry, on and on. She won a 2011 Pushcart Prize for her poem, The Case for Free Will. Patty grew up in Detroit. She earned a BS and an MS in journalism from Northwestern, an MFA in poetry right here at UCI, and a PhD in poetry and literature from the University of Houston. She's a professor at Cal State Long Beach. We are talking about Threshold Delivery. It is her fifth collection. It's published by Finishing Line Press. She joins me in the studio this morning. Patty, welcome.
Thank you, Marie. Good morning.
Good morning. So listeners well know that we do primarily a lot of fiction on the show, novels and short stories. And often, very often in the course of these interviews, the novelist or the short story writer will offer advice. And the advice is always read more poetry. and their observation is always that poetry is by far the most difficult form of prose. And so I was wondering, you know, because they always say, oh, God, I could never do that. But you need to read more of it. So I wonder if we could start sort of before we dive into the collection with your kind of observations and insights into this intimidation factor or the feeling of inaccessibility or, you know, that a lot of readers have and kind of perhaps how to overcome it.
Well, I think that people want to feel like they get it. And one of the problems with poetry is that getting it is a process, and it's sort of that happens in layers, sort of like unpeeling an onion. So you don't really ever read a poem and say, aha, I get it. You get some aspect of it, and then it leaves you feeling a little bit uneasy. And I think that's ideally poems leave you feeling a little bit uneasy. What I say to my students is that I don't want to necessarily feel satisfied and complete after reading a poem. I want to feel just a little bit nauseous, which, you know, they think, well, that's really what you want us to do. But I often feel that sense of unease in the course of writing a poem. But I've learned to love that feeling, that sense of discovery, and then I'm in the process of discovery. So for a reader, it's a bit of a challenge because you're saying you want me to read something and not feel good and not, you know, at the end of it, and not even feel like necessarily as though I learned something and I have a takeaway. Really, a good poem leaves you with something to think about, you know. So I think sometimes that makes people a little bit nervous, but in my experience, good readers rise to the challenge, and when they enter into a book of poems that meets them at least part way, they realize that they do get it, and they realize that there's something very satisfying about entering into that relationship with the writer and entering into the process of understanding with the writer, that in fact it is a relationship, and that the writer, the poet, needs you every bit as much as theoretically you need the poet. And I love fiction. I don't have the gift of writing fiction, but I like that sense of unease and that sense that the writer needs me in some way to complete the writing. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's a little bit intimidating for readers, and you know, especially in our culture where we are delivered so much information. You know, and poetry says, "I'll give you some, but come to me a little bit too." You know, and I think that sometimes gives people pause, but I also think it's immensely satisfying.
Right.
So.
Yeah, because you're not. Yeah, it's the one time when you're not going to tell people how to feel about something,
mm-hmm,
and they've
mm-hmm,
they've
right.
got to do a lot of work, and there's always the feeling of I'm too stupid to read poetry. I don't know if it's that we were like beaten with Milton as kids or something, you know, mm-hmm. or we're all scared of it a little bit. But
I think it starts in high school,
yeah.
and that high school teachers are doing a better and better job of exposing students to poems and to collections that are modern voices, you know, mm-hmm. and that are not. And once you've done that, and once kids have a point of entry, then you can take them back and say, "Hey, here's Coleridge, and he actually sounds like a regular guy when you read him." You know, when you say, you know, he's miserable because all his friends are able to take a walk and he can't, and so he's sort of whining about this lime tree bower, my prison. You realize once kids have sort of once they've entered in with a modern voice, they realize, oh. People's concerns have been the same forever.
Right.
Forever.
Right.
You know, so
who are those modern poets that you, in addition to yourself, who you find accessible enough to help kids enter?
Well, I think Elizabeth Bishop, mm-hmm. you know, is great, and in that way, and her sort of long descriptive poems, you know, in which she sounds so conversational, and then she even corrects herself in the course of the poem. And there's also kind of an exuberance in her poems when, you know, in The Fish, when she rainbow, 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 you know, and she. Mm-hmm. So I think she's a good one. I know it's sort of old school in some sense. You know, Frost is the best kind of plain language poet still there is, you know, yeah. and when sometimes I still think to myself, something there is that doesn't love a wall, you know, and when you think about good fences make good neighbors and all those little things that came from his poems, I like a Chinese-American poet named Li Yung Li.
Oh, yeah.
And who yeah. is actually a graphic designer, interestingly. And for me, the poems that he writes about his father, I've recommended them to many friends of mine who have said, "Do you have a poem?" This is a poet's occupational hazard. It's like doctors at a wedding. I'm not feeling so well. Poets get, you know, I need a poem for something, which is actually a great of all the occupational hazards you can have. It's a good one,
good one,
you know.
Yeah.
But Li Yung Li's, I think they're so lyrical and beautiful, and but also really speak to the very deep relationships in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So those are three that I like.
I always like Sharon Olds.
I like Sharon Olds a lot. I think that Louise Glick, particularly in some of the earlier works, I think really speaks. And then Philip Larkin is a real favorite of mine. He was not a good man at all, you know, which is sort of funny to say that I used to think when I was younger that being a poet would make you a better person.
Mm-hmm.
And then you run across poets and you read their biographies. You're like, that's not a good person at all. And yet somehow they're writing work that is so personal and so vulnerable, mm-hmm. you know? And for me, Larkin is one of those poets where he's, you know, exposes, you know, the kind of the vulnerabilities that we all have, and including the angers and the kind of cantankerousness and the bitterness and the envy and the things that real people feel, versus I think sometimes we think of poets as being sort of semi angelic, you know,
above
it all, mm-hmm. you know. And so I love when a poet says, "No, not at all," you know.
Right, right. I love it. So let's get into the collection,
okay.
and talk about Threshold Delivery, kind of. The poems came together over kind of what period of time and what was on your mind in this collection. Versus, I always like talking to writers who've put out, you know, four or five collections, which you now have,
mm-hmm.
and what themes kind of have endured through time for you, and if you can see yourself progressing to say, okay, that, you know, that was concerns of my 20s and now I'm mm-hmm. not in my 20s and what's concerning me now. But what was the time frame over which these were written?
They were probably written over a course of about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say I wasn't working on other poems during those 10 years, but these were written around the time that I lost my mother, which was in 2005, and most after that. And I think that the mortality and loss ever since my 20s have actually been something that's been on my mind, which makes me sound like a pretty miserable person. And I'm actually fairly joyful, and I think of myself as a fairly celebratory poet, which is funny to say that I think. But I wrote my first poems about mortality when I lost my father when I was in my 20s, and they were not good, but I needed to write them. Mm-hmm. And a couple of them were not bad and found their way into my first book. But there's a couple of themes that keep keep sort of running through my work. One of them is actually free will, which is interesting. And in almost every book I've published, I have a poem, and the Pushcart Prize poem, the one was The Case for Free Will. Like, I'm very interested in human agency and how much choice we have and how we make decisions, and that is sort of our gift, is free will. So free will loss is something. The idea of expectations and hope are very interesting to me. Hope is actually, to me, a tremendous concept. Mm-hmm. And forgiveness is something. And it's funny, when I was at UCI as a grad student in the early 90s, I wrote a poem that showed up in my first book called On Forgiveness, and my professor at the time, Jim McMichael, said, and I took everything he said as very wise, and I still think that way. He said, I'm not sure what forgiveness is. And I had never heard anybody talk about a concept that way. You know, and there was part of me that wanted to say, well, I can tell you what forgiveness is. You know, I was 30. You know, I can tell you what forgiveness is, Jim.
Look it up.
yeah, you know, but I later came to understand what he was saying, that this is so much more complicated, Patty, than you may be making it out to be. And I realized that the idea of forgiveness is very potent to me and is very meaningful. And I think of it in a way, and in terms of my own mother, who forgave, but she never forgot anything.
Right.
You know, and I'm a little bit like that, too. You know, which is for better and worse.
So, we're writers, after all.
I'm strangely forgiving, but I don't forget.
Right.
So, you know,
it is funny to look back over the thematic issues, but obviously you don't sit down to write a poem and say, "I'm going to write about forgiveness," or "I'm going to write about loss," or grieving, or whatever. I'm sure it starts with, you know, I don't know what it starts with, but probably an image or probably a line of dialogue you've heard from somebody that resonates, or, you know, it starts with something more concrete and then moves to this thematic idea over time. And I don't know at what point you look at the collection and say, this is really what this was about, like when the aboutness of what it is comes to you.
I think that the putting together collection thematically is a little bit like the process of each individual poems, which for me I would liken to a very unromantic notion of gathering lint in your pocket, which is to say, little bits of information, little pieces of language, little sounds start to kind of accrue and kind of attach themselves to one another. And at some point you look and say, oh, this is sort of interesting how this, you know, how this image seems to track to that image. And, oh, I like that piece of language. I like how that sounds. And when I play with that piece of language and I almost make kind of a mental word map around that language, oh, look, I get taken to this different set of sounds, you know. And so it's very random in some sense. There's no intention. There's no purpose. There's nothing intentional for me about writing any single poem. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never said, I'm going to write about loss. I'm going to write about pain. I'm going to write about, you know, I've looked at a scar that I have on my wrist and thought like, yeah, how about that scar? Mm-hmm. And I've written about that scar and I've described the scar, and then that scar has taken me into a sort of a reverie on something of an idea. But I'm very much in that school of no ideas, button things, you know, that the concrete and the thingness is much more important than the idea, you know, and that the idea will come. I say to my students, don't, you're deep, fine, now shake it off. You know, right. It's, you know, I've anointed you as deep. Now let's write some poems, you know. Right. So, the process of putting together a book is in a way sort of similar. You kind of look at everything that you're writing and say, and ideally you can sort of step back from it and you try to look at it from, if not 30,000 feet, you know, 1,000 feet and say, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. You know, what seems to be running through here? What's this about? And I realized that, I was, you know, really trying to process issues surrounding loss, grief, mourning. Mm-hmm. And not only because of the loss of my second parent, you know, but both of my husband's parents died circa those times. And I started to see it with my, you know, friends' parents as well, too, that, you know, in some sense you have to confront, what is this? How do we process this? You know, right. how do we process loss when it is inevitable? And in the order that it should be, which is to say the loss of parents, you know, as we know, the worst thing is the reverse, the loss of, you know, the child first. And there's a little poem in this book that talks about that, where my mother's older brother died as a child, and how, you know, she always said to me that her mother never got over it, you know. And until you have kids, of course, you, that's theoretical. And it sounds terrible. Once you have kids, you realize, oh, that is the worst. And it's very odd to hear yourself say, oh, of course I want to die before my children. Just it's the first part of that sentence that's hard, but the rest of it makes it palatable.
It's odd, right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's, so I think in this book, like my others, at some point the poems kind of became Lent and started to sort of attach themselves and enter into a dialogue with each other.
Yeah.
And then you try to order the book in a sense that things are not too close together, but there's a little bit of, you know, some sense of variation where you're kind of coming at a subject from a variety of different angles. And ultimately, there's sort of some centrality to it once you finish the book a couple of times, but, you know, maybe even not. You know, so helpful, right?
My guest this morning is Patty Seaburn. The book is Threshold Delivery. So the title of the collection is not a poem. There is not a title poem of Threshold Delivery. And I think titles are so impossible in general. They have to do a lot of work. And even worse for poets and short story writers who have to do them, you know, 20 times instead of just once, like a novelist does. So talk a little bit about the choosing that title as the overarching theme to bring all of the Lent together.
Gotcha. Threshold. I'm very interested in the idea of, and my faith tradition, which is to say I'm a Reformed Jew, is very interested in the idea of how you kind of, in a way, bring somebody toward death and the kind of, in a way, the dignity and the practices involved in that. And I actually heard the phrase threshold delivery by a delivery man, which is true, which is in the poem Davenport.
Yeah.
I was having a couch delivered and I said, oh, can you bring it in the house? Because it was so heavy. And he said, threshold delivery, ma'am. And I love when that sort of thing happens, because immediately when he said that, I thought, oh, that's a phrase. You know, right. That's going to have some currency, which is actually what happened for me with my second book, Mechanical Cluster. I was in the car wash, and I was reading my Ford user's manual. And they said, your vehicle has a mechanical cluster. And I started banging on my car window. My husband's like, what's wrong? He thinks I'm suffocating inside my Ford Probe, you know. And I said, I've got my book title, because I realized that I was really writing about kind of the human body and the kind of the brain, and that in some sense the phrase mechanical cluster was exactly what I wanted. And I felt that with Threshold Delivery, when he said Threshold Delivery, which helped me get over the fact that my couch was in my driveway.
Stuck outside, yeah.
Right. So and then there's another poem in here where sort of, you know, I talk about my mother and that threshold and that liminal space, which is, you know, crossing the Levy, you know, and route to souls and route to the final resting place. And so I was just very interested in that kind of crossing over. And I'm interested in poetic crossings in general. And this is, of course, that threshold from life to death is the last great crossing. And so I just thought that that seemed to me what the book was about. And I, you know, when I think about my mom now, I think about those couple of years before she died and how challenging that was, you know, and how difficult it was in essence to kind of usher her through that process when you know the body and the mind are not working the way they need to anymore. And so in a way, to be her Virgil, and it wasn't just me, it was my brothers and her friends and her community. And this is true, of course, for everybody, you know, that everybody has sort of ideally, it's not a solo journey, you mm-hmm. know. And so the idea of the threshold delivery, that then I could sort of write this book that would in a way be a little bit of an instruction manual even for myself of like, how do you usher somebody with dignity toward that final crossing? And then you step back personally from the crossing and you have to be able to say, I did what I could, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult, and I think very few of us actually, including myself, have a feeling of satisfaction about what you did, if you did what you could do. I envy the people who feel a real sense of satisfaction with that. I can still look back and think, oh, I wish I had this.
Right.
You know, I wish I had done that. And, you know, but I think that's where the title comes from. But Threshold Delivery also speaks a little bit to my sort of kind of quirky sense of humor, which right. is to say, you know, I have this sort of interaction with my couch delivery guy who also says, I have boundaries too, ma'am. You know, and it's not all about you. This is what I do, and this is where I'm told to stop. And I like that about people. And I have to remind myself sometimes that it's not all about me.
So great.
So
there is a lot of humor in here. Maybe this is a good time to read Davenport. Do okay. you want to read that?
Great.
And then we can set the stage and talk about it a little more.
Absolutely. Davenport. And I want to say, I think that title comes from, there was a camp song when I was a girl that where you spelled out the word Davenport, which was a kind of couch. And I don't know if they make them anymore, but I love the word Davenport.
I do too.
When I asked the men to bring my couch inside, they shook their heads. Threshold delivery, ma'am. And I pictured them lovingly carrying my movable the way a bride once was hoisted. This was before me. Though not before some my age, those who relish putting a nice meal on the table nightly. We trouble each other. Trouble often comes in threes, and I am often found waiting for a dropped shoe or something heavier and pointy, a spike-heeled boot, part of a pair, which means there is a lone shoe somewhere. My husband sold shoes. Four on the floor, he taught me, you should be presented with choices, and the shoe dog should be kneeling like a prince. I invented the last part. Princes don't work in retail, though it would help if the aristocracy were trained to do something useful. I have a practical streak that gets dyed each 6 weeks, now every four. It is hard to hide. I loathe hide and seek. Scarred from having not been found, waiting too patiently, somewhere dark. Back then, we did not know these moments would cling, regulars at the dive bar of your dreams. We thought they were singular, forgettable. I remember living on an edge, how blithely I averted hazard, nimble-footed. I cannot run as fast now but have much better endurance.
We were talking before the show about prose poetry and your kind of, not hesitation, but the challenges of a prose poem. So if when you buy this book, dear listener, you will notice that it is a prose poem. It's one graph, sort of, and very associative. And we were talking about the importance of when you do a prose poem and you don't have the line breaks, finding those really pleasurable kind of word associations that create these leaps. I don't know the question here. Kind of talk a little bit about that and maybe it was sort of the challenges of the prose poem and making those associative leaps and kind of where this poem started and the revision process. And
sure. I think that prose poems have a high level of risk to them for me because, for one, each sentence has to matter and each sentence has to be extremely well wrought because prose poems, for the most part, operate from sentence to sentence. And the sentence is a beautiful thing. You know, it's such a, there's such a wholeness to it. But the danger of a prose poem is because it's a block of gray text, it's easy to let your eyes sort of skim over it. So you actually have I think lawyers call it a higher burden of proof, a higher burden of needing to hold the reader's attention. So each sentence has to have some rhythmic juice, and it also has to have some meaning, some point of interest. And this is, of course, true of every poem. But when you have line breaks, you get some energy from the white space that drives you off into the next line. You get no energy from white space in a prose poem. So you really just are saying to the reader, keep going, keep moving right to left, to right to left, to right to left. And so I think prose poems are difficult in that way. I think I'm actually pretty good at line breaks. And so that sounds terrible, but I do.
Yes, you're very good at line
thank
breaks.
You.
Yes,
but yeah. But so I think with prose poems, that's an interesting challenge. I do, when I write a prose poem, I do tend to move in a sort of associative fashion from, you know, shoe to prince to a different prince to hiding to hide and seek to darkness. And then at some point, the prose poem, if you're working from sort of image to image, little event to event, scene to scene, at some point, it leads you down a dark hole. You know, and that's really what happens, I think, that's what happens at the end of this poem, where it says, I loathe, hide, and seek, scarred from having not been found, waiting too patiently. Somewhere dark. And then, you know, then when you sort of realize that all these moments, you know, at the end of the poem that we seemed to think were random moments, which in a way is sort of what the prose poem mimics, actually are not random, and they've been accruing and they've been affecting you and potentially scarring you, and you have to process them in some way that they don't just leave you alone and you don't just leave them behind.
Right.
And I think that that's what happens in this poem. And then there's just little bits of truth that come in with the line, I cannot run as fast now, but have much better endurance. This is absolutely true. And I think it also speaks to getting older. You
yes.
know, I can't run as fast as I could when I was a teenager, but I ran a marathon when I was 40, a very slow marathon, you know, but I could do that. And I could never have done that at 18 when I could run a decent mile, you know. So quite literally it was true, but metaphorically also the sense that I'm in this for the long haul and I'm not as interested in sort of short-term gain and short-term reward, you know. But the idea of kind of delayed gratification, you know, comes in sort of at the end of this poem, but also recognizing what resonates from your childhood and how you can run, but you can't hide, that it will stick with you, you know.
Right. So when you sat down on day one before this, the original kernel, do you remember what it was?
Of this poem?
Yeah.
The original kernel, yeah. Well, I think that I would say that the original image from here was my husband, who sold shoes at Nordstrom's and for many years. And he would tell me about this when we met. And I love jobs. I say this to my students, all jobs have a certain language, you know, languages involved, you know, and, you know, to sell shoes, you know, he said, well, the shoe salesman, we were called shoe dogs, and we would go back into the, you know, where the shoes were, and those were the walls. And so there was this whole language of selling shoes. Mm-hmm. And there was, he said, we would put four on the floor. If you came in and asked for one shoe, we would bring you four because you're in there and we have you there. And I still think about that when I go shoe shopping. Every now and then I want to say, somebody put down four. What the heck? I'm here. It's, but I remember just being really entranced with the idea of the kind of, there's even rituals and language to those shoes. And there is something, of course, you know, when you go back to just your childhood fairy tale of that shoe being slipped on Cinderella, trying to get that to fit.
Right.
And I was thinking about this morning, you know, the notion of kind of fitting and fitting in. And the idea of fitting in is so appealing. And yet, for most poets, including myself, I think we're so much more comfortable not fitting in, you know. And yet, we're human. You know, there's always that moment where you think, why can't I fit in a little better? You know, and so I think that sense, the sort of sense of like the shoe dog, the fitting, that was where this poem started, which is funny because you could argue that it's the least important part of the poem. It sort of shows up in the middle.
Right.
The threshold delivery, that event did not happen till much later, and the kind of the revelation that this would take me back into childhood and into the idea to sort of the need to run, the need to escape, the need to be fast and to be nimble in this life, that didn't come till later either.
Interesting. So over what time period was this written, would you say?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure it took me months. I would say it was really in the middle of when I was writing. I was working on a couple other the longer poems in this collection that deal more overtly with my mother, like Location, Location, mm-hmm. and a poem called Apology at a Shirley and Coleridge. I was working on these prose poems sort of simultaneously because the longer poems are exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think in way of kind of breathing exercises, taking a long poem, you just have to take a lot of deep breaths and be patient and know that you're kind of, that you're working your way through a journey. And a poem like this, which happens sort of in journalistic terms in shorter takes, it's kind of a relief to be able to say, I'm going to think in these little sporadic associative ways for today, for this week, for this month, versus working on this longer poem that ultimately will make you very sad because you're writing about loss and you're writing about death. So it's kind of nice. So I was writing these at the same time as those, but in a way to give myself sort of a break.
Right. What, picking up on one thing you said about picking up languages from other occupations, mm-hmm. and I had read about you that you sort of devour different languages, like you read Scientific American or you mm-hmm. pick up Stephen Hawking, or mm-hmm. you draw from a lot of different disciplines and read widely across, you know, biology and science, and they all have their own language, obviously,
mm-hmm.
That's fertile ground for poetry. And I think that's an important thing to point out to writers, is that, you know, you should have your hand in a lot of different pots,
mm-hmm.
maybe to draw inspiration.
I agree. And I say to my students, you know, what's going on in your other classes? You know, what mm-hmm. you're reading history, you're reading about anthropology, you're reading linguistics. What's the language of linguistics? What are the terms that are sort of interesting that can find their way in? And, you know, and I really encourage them to do it. Sort of get out of your own head. What are you learning at this point? And what's sticking with you? Because the pieces of language that are attaching themselves to you are doing so for a reason, because they have something to teach you. So embrace them, welcome mm-hmm. them, versus saying that's not what poetry is made of. Poetry is lyrical, and sometimes poetry is the bird outside your window, but sometimes it's also, you know, a funny technical term that slips into your consciousness and that you think, that's fascinating. You know, why do I like that little piece of language or that little idea? So I agree. I think it's really important to read. And research is so easy right now.
Right.
you know, right. that none of us as writers, I think, have any excuse for thinking, oh, I can only know what is immediately surrounding me.
Right.
Because we have our opportunities to acquire different bodies of knowledge are so available.
Infinite.
Yes. Yeah.
It's also a nice way to jar yourself out of, you know, I'm going to sit down and write a poem and inevitably it's going to have nature in it.
Right.
You're
right.
The bird out the window.
Right. Right.
It's a good way to break yourself of that little crutch or whatever it is that new writers. So before we dive into the next poem, which I want to do, is kind of what makes or breaks a poem. I know you've talked about, you know, cliche and being too clever or cute is mm-hmm. just the death knell for a poem. Are there things that you can look at either a new writer, even an established writer, and say, this is where your poem is broken down?
I think that the biggest risk a writer, of the biggest hazard for a writer is thinking that we're more interesting than we are. And that sounds terrible, and so I have to throw myself in the soup with it. I don't entertain the idea that I'm so interesting, you know, that I really, but I think that at my best moments, the way I think has the potential to be interesting, not the way I live my life. You know, I say to my students, most of us do roughly the same thing every day. We get up, we eat breakfast, we have to do something for somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, we transport ourselves to wherever we have a certain set of obligations, be it work or school or, you know, but I think, and so the idea that that what we do in our daily lives is so interesting, I think is hazardous for writers. And I think when writers make the mistake of thinking that everything they do is fascinating, that the poems reflect a kind of narcissism that often people attach to poetry, and sometimes rightly so, you know, which is dismaying as a lover of poetry. When an individual poem goes wrong, it's generally, I think, because it knows where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it knows where it's going, then the cliches start following. They attach themselves like, you know, little creatures, you know, to the poem. The cliches start following. And the cleverness, because I figured out something, attaches. And, you know, it's interesting. Cleverness is a funny word. I'm an advocate of humor. And of a lens on the world that recognizes how strange and funny things are. But cleverness is tougher, and that's something that I've had to fight off at certain points in my life. There's certain poems I write that are a little clever, and I just get them out of my system, and nobody sees them, you know, because I just needed to write that. It's almost like a journal entry, and I don't keep a journal, although I think we all should. I think if the world would be a better place, I wish I did, but I don't. And, I think cleverness is a problem, but I really think it's that knowing where the poem's going, I want to write about this, that is often the death knell for a poem. And it can happen at any point in the poem. A poem can start out solid and interesting and moving in ways that you think, oh, I want to hang out with this poet. And this poet's sort of doing a good job of kind of leading me through something sort of strange and interesting and fun or funny or odd. And then at some point, when the grip becomes too tight and the poet's like, I know where I'm going, then you just, much like a bad high school relationship, you just want to shake it off. You're like, you don't hold my hands so tight. You know, I'm so, leave me alone. I want to go hang out with my friends, you know. So it's, I think that is a danger sometimes.
So do you think the test is then that you as writer are surprised by yourself, and that is a signal that the subconscious is working over the conscious? Because it sounds like when the conscious mind takes over, that's when things start falling apart.
I think so. And Ben Shahn, a painter I've liked, wrote a book called The Shape of Content for the Charles Eliot Norton lectures at Harvard many, many years ago. And he really writes about the sort of the intention, which is the conscious self, and the subconscious, you know, which is the subconscious is really the generator. And that you need the conscious self to edit, to say, oh, there's some cool stuff going on here, but musically, this poem is sort of random. You know, there's extra words. There's a lot of prepositional phrases. I'm being a little too generous, or I'm explaining things too much, you know. And so the conscious self edits and revises and says, let's make this more efficient. Do we really need that extra syllable rhythmically is throwing things off? How can we compress? How can we get rid of it? Is there a better word for that? So that conscious self is very important, but the subconscious self has to be, for me anyway, the generator. And even in the revision process, I'm still always trying to access the subconscious self. Mm-hmm. So I'll try to take little riffs off. I'll sort of circle a point in a poem and I'll say, kind of riff on that, like a jazz riff, like just sort of go off and see where that takes you. And sometimes that riff takes you somewhere where the poem was not planning on going at all. And then you say to the rest of the poem, sorry, you know, mm-hmm. bye-bye, you know, so, and you go off in that more interesting direction because musically you trusted that there was something there. There was some little mind, something sort of unexplored there that was going to be more interesting than where the poem had taken you before. And I think you have to trust that.
Mm-hmm.
And that trust is very, to trust the subconscious is difficult, mm-hmm. you know, because mm-hmm. It's the conscious self that gets us through the day, you know, and we have to trust the conscious self. When I get on the road, I have to say, where are you going? How are you going to get there? Don't go on autopilot. You know, you can't go into some sort of subconscious reverie. You have to make your decision. And sometimes you're thinking, oh, the 405 is crowded. I'm going to get off at Baker. You know, you have to sort of see, you're constantly making these conscious decisions. You're not intuiting where to drive, you
right.
know. So it can be difficult to trust the subconscious self. But I think in the writing process, it's very important. So.
Well, speaking of driving, I know you use driving as a sort of device to trick yourself or to generate some of these ideas. I feel like driving and running, mm-hmm. and there's probably some other flow activities that mm-hmm. it takes a certain percentage of your conscious mind to get yourself, as you say, off the 405.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens up this pathway to the subconscious mind to let kind of all of these other ideas kind of percolate. I feel like driving, running, some of these activities are very good generative. Taking a shower. I always mm-hmm. have good ideas in the shower and then I don't have a notebook to write them down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good. But yeah, and you shouldn't be writing down in the car either. But anyway, it's I think there is something to that.
One of my professors at UCI used to talk about the work away from the page and how important that is, you know, and that idea of, I think running is a great one too, where sometimes I think of working out a poem as sort of a word problem, you mm-hmm. know, like that you kind of, and that when I used to run more and sometimes I'll still do this, I think about, oh God, you kind of got in a pickle there. How are you going to get yourself out of it? And when I'm not confronted with the page, when I just have to think about it away, there is something very productive about that.
Yeah.
You know, about giving yourself that time, which is why when people say, you know, to most of us who teach or who write, you know, what do you do all day? It's so hard to explain. Well, I'm doing the work away from the page. You know, it
right.
makes you sound flaky and flakier than we are. And
process involves eating this donut.
Right. <That's part laughs> exactly. I'm doing it very thoughtfully and meditatively and right. writing a poem while I'm doing it. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Patty Seaborn. The book is Threshold Delivery. Let's do either location or Apologia to Shirley and Coleridge. I don't know which one makes most sense from a, like, this was difficult, you struggled with it in some way or something surprised you about it. But let's do one of those beautiful line break poems. Obviously, people will have to pick up the collection so they can see all of these beautiful line breaks. But
thank you.
Go ahead.
I think I'll read Apologia to Shirley and Coleridge because it was a harder poem for me to write in some sense. And because I still like the ending, which is Coleridge at the ending. So I mentioned before that Coleridge was a poet I liked in part because he sounded like people I knew, you know, and I thought his concerns... and the poems he wrote, called the conversation poems, were really, they were conversational and they sounded like they were talking to his buds. And so I really attached on to him. And my mom's name was Shirley. So this is called Apologia to Shirley and Coleridge. I will say there's some references to Jewish traditions in here, and I think I explained them in the poem, which is why it takes a little long. If my house, my car, my vine and fig, my lot were all to disappear, still I'd own regret, Ma, my share and my inheritance. At Yom Kippur, we wrestle with mistakes. We sway, we bend, atone. Vidui, I have sinned, I have gone astray, transgressed. And with all my heart, my soul, my might, the language of my childhood siddur parallels and these and thous intact. The language of the sanctuary's antiquated lore. I believe the Rebbe wrong who said, the dead can hear all that is uttered in their presence up until the day they rest, the grave's lid sealed. Others scoffed, until the body yields to worm, beyond the pall of what the mystics termed the hammered image, crafted by God's angel, Samael, second string, don't quote me, who inflicts the final wound with gall or wormwood, poison on a sword the naked eye cannot detect and so cannot reject. Our sages count 900, give or take, different ways to die, though recent architects of woe have added to the minions. I pray you were assigned the one called by the kiss, reserved for righteous sorts, though not without their flaws, a little lower than the angels, but more loved, the soul's departure without pain. The drawing of a hair from milk, their analogy. Mine, the narrow line of light in Barnett Newman's Station of the Cross, the 12th, the intermediary in a rectangle of night. I hear my children cry out in their dreams, though no sound escapes their lips, how loud they are. Their dreams are loud and technicolor, drawn by fears they cannot name in case a word can will a thing, not since the garden, dear. Do you hear my mea culpa, Ma? I have always been the one who loved contrition, friend of guilt, and what could I have done? And so I'm sorry that I could not pull your mind back to the present, though the present was a prison, even with your favorite lines from Shakespeare. Mewling, puking, you would laugh the way a kid laughs nervily at what's forbidden. I'm sorry, too, for that awful poem you loved about the trees, how I tried to make you run the lines in hopes the easy scheme would trick your brain into remembering, and sorry for the stench, for saying, eat a little pudding, please, for sitting by your bed amazed at time's slow-stalking pace, no winged chariot did I hear. And sorry that I was not there to lie you down with dignity. Feet pointed toward the door, water pouring around so demons wouldn't dare cross over, they're afraid. And was not there when Duma would escort your soul to the courtyard of the dead. We're told that when the soul departs, the flesh. A cry goes forth from one end of the world clean to the other, but the voice cannot be heard like the serpent sloughing off its skin. Hear, we say, O Israel, a faith that favors ear and disbelieves the eye. The wise man says a person who recites the Kaddish with conviction may annul a harsh divine decree against him. I think the prayer reminds the dead of how the living sound, droning, rhythmic, repetitious, distant from the music of the spheres. I say Kaddish from my mother, so she'll know I heard the cry one cannot hear, the music absence makes, stolen from the garden after Eve and Adam's endless error, and all the naming fled into silence, not a hiss, not a whisper. And then Shirley said, enough already. Talk. I will listen. No sound is dissonant. She nods to a gentleman imprisoned in a lime tree bower, which tells of life.
That was Patti Seaborn reading Apologia to Shirley and Coleridge from the new collection just out, Threshold Delivery. How much time distance do you need from emotional events do you feel like to process it? Like, could you have written this in the 3 to 6 months after your mother passed?
No, I think I need years. Mm-hmm. I think I needed... probably several years, although I started gathering the material very soon after she died. I went to the rabbi at my synagogue, Rabbi Miller of blessed memory, and I said to him, I want to write about my mother. And we talked about, you know, her death, and he looked in his library, which was remarkable, and got down a stack of books, you know, climbed up the ladder to the third floor and gave me these books and said, essentially, here you go. And then basically said, is this how you're going to play this? He said, you know, really, like, we can do this dance of that this is what you need to do right now. But really, this is your way of mourning, and just know that that's what this is, that right. This meeting and this gathering of material and this approach is really your way of dealing with loss, you know.
So this is therapy. This is not yet art.
Right, right. You know, yeah. That this sort of information gathering session is useful. And here you go. I'm giving you what you're asking for, but this is really part of your mourning process. And this is really, and I thought that was wise and made sense. And I took home the books and they sat in the corner of my desk for a while, mm-hmm. until I felt probably guilty enough that I needed to return them to him. So at which point I took notes, I Xeroxed the pages that I thought, you know, and I took a giant file of notes and I returned the books. And then I sat on those for a while because the note taking was exhausting, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm sure I didn't start writing probably for another 2 or 3 years after that, and then started entering the poems. But by that point, I still didn't know how I was going to address this and even what the point was. You know, there's nothing you can do about anything, you know, but I wanted to stay in some way in a dialogue with my mother,
right.
You know, and because I felt that she deserved that,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, and I think that's ideally what we take from and what we inherit from people, and that we stay in those conversations. And I still every now and then, you know, will kind of converse, you know, in some sense with my mom. And I feel like these poems are conversations with her, and that I still in a way have a lot to learn from, especially now that I'm a parent, mm-hmm. you know, and I still have a lot to learn from what was taught me and what was showed me, and some of it in a good way and some by default. I'm going to do mm-hmm. that. I'm not going to do that, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but that's okay.
Right.
That's
right.
All right, too. So.
I do always think that that's an interesting discussion between, you know, what is therapy and when does therapy end and what is art and when mm-hmm. does art begin? And,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, obviously you're making art from grief, mm-hmm. but they are two very different things and, you know,
yeah, and I'm an advocate of both. I'm a yeah. giant advocate of therapy. But I also am very aware of that line between what is therapeutic and what is the making of art that needs to evoke an emotional and a cathartic response from somebody else.
Right.
So.
Right. The other wonderful thing about this is religion giving you a language. I don't have any religious background, mm-hmm. but religion giving you yet another texture. You know, we were talking about Scientific America or Stephen Hawking mm-hmm. or all of these. Mm-hmm. Religion is such a wonderful place to go, I would imagine, for, you know, these ideas and phrases and philosophies and mm-hmm. things that would really, I mean, obviously feeds your work to a tremendous degree, but really any writer, I think, could glean quite a lot from, you know, any religious discipline they choose to draw from, there's so much rich material there.
Absolutely. I say to my students, whatever you believe or don't believe is good with me, but just know that the sort of struggle is an interesting one, is a compelling one, and is an intellectual struggle that most writers go through at some point in their life, and that it's all material.
Right.
It's just all, there's such weirdness, and that weirdness is such, is so fecund, you know, for a writer. So there's great material like, no, this is what the soul does. No, that's what the soul does. I didn't come up with that, you know? Right. But I love being able to use that as part of my heritage, you know, and as part of my tradition. And, it makes me feel more connected, and it makes it all feel more useful to me.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I can't believe we're totally out of time. But what I had really wanted to do, and I maybe can do in the blog post with this, is you have just a number of wonderful exercises for students to try, for poets to try, even for, I think, for writers who are not poets, but, you know, who need the exercises to try. So I'm going to include those elsewhere, maybe on the blog post. But is there other writing advice or wisdom that you routinely tell your students that proves helpful?
I think that I say to them, there are 24 hours in a day. There are 48 half hours in a day. If you can give yourself over one half hour, 1/48th of a day, you know, to writing, if you can give yourself that one half hour and prioritize that and get out of your own way while you're doing it, you know, and not hold yourself to the burden of, I need to write something great. Just, I'm going to commit some language to the page. I'm going to commit to language for 1.5 hours. Then your writing will change. And I actually believe what Rilke says at the end of Archaic Torso of Apollo. He says, you must change your life. I think your life will change, you know?
Yeah. Getting out of your own way is no easy feat, I have to say. Well,
no,
first
it's not.
Of all, you have to turn off the internet. You get out of your way. You have to let the world get out of your way. But yeah.
Yep.
And you, are you doing any readings, or can people?
I'm actually
find you?
Reading up at the Wilshire, one of the public libraries in Mid Wilshire on Saturday. So
Perfect.
That'll be fun. I'm excited about that, and I'll be setting up things here this summer. So I'll be around. Marie, thank you so much.
Is there a place we can find you online so people can follow some of your, do you have like a...
I have a Facebook page. I'm lousy at it, but yes, I, that's pretty much where I try to post readings. So thank you.
Sounds good. That is all the time we have for today. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. The name of my guest completely escapes me as I'm sitting here, but Henry himself is the book. Stuart Onan is going to be here next week. So that will be a treat. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for more great programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.